Ooh, you want to play psycho killer? Can I be the helpless victim?
Cross your eyes and scream, man. Scream for your life!
Welcome. I'm your Scream Queen, Jenica Olin. This is my 22nd episode. My theme for this month is April Fuels Fury, with some gotcha moments where the punchline is your death. This whole month is about women's revenge because horror is inherently feminist and casts a light on all the ways women and girls are targets of violent acts. We are currently under attack in America right now with a bill out there that will disenfranchise a bunch of women with their voters' rights and not having autonomy over our own bodies. Once again, women are the sacrifice for men like Trump to make a mad grab at power. If you're new here, each episode will have an intro, brief synopsis of the movie, an analysis of the film, and then I get into the true horrors of it all. I'm a huge true crime fan, and I like to make connections between the true horrors that inspire our darkest imaginations. The truth is, the stuff on screen is way tamer than the true horrors that take place every day. Spoiler alert, I've made it my job to spoil the shit out of this movie. Today, I'll be covering Jennifer's Body. This movie came out in 2009, directed by Kieran Kusama and written by Diablo Cody, starring Megan Fox, Amanda Seyfried, and Adam Brody. The estimated budget for this film was $16 million, and the estimated gross was $31 million. Tagline for this film is, "She's evil, and not just high school evil." Some quick trivia about this film: the waterfall that goes nowhere is the Devil's Kettle. At Judge Magni State Park in Minnesota, the water disappears into a glacial pothole. Hershey's chocolate syrup was used for Jennifer's black vomit scene, along with the use of CGI animation. The movie's title is from the song Jennifer's Body by Courtney Love's band Hole. Blake Lively turned down the role of Jennifer Check due to scheduling conflicts with Gossip Girl. Megan Fox was later cast, and that was such a better choice. Blake Lively sucks, and I don't think that it's not like a hot take. She just sucks as a person. The original script was bloodier than the final version. Originally, it would show more scenes of Jennifer tearing apart her male victims, including Jennifer feeding on her victims' testicles in reference to how succubi feed on their victims' semen. Low Shoulder was a fictional name given to the band in the movie. In real life, the band was known as No Country. They were called No Country from 2009 until 2014, when they changed their name to Wildling. Before No Country, the band had been known as Test Your Reflex from 2004 to 2009. Lead singer Ryan Levine wrote much of the original music heard in the movie. In the scene where Jennifer seduces Needy before they kiss, Jennifer is wearing an Evil Dead t-shirt. Plus, there's an Evil Dead poster on the wall of the bedroom, which is center screen for part of the scene. Both movies have an evil force in the woods that take possession of a young female and that prey on school friends. Let's set the scene with a synopsis of the movie.
Chip is looking really cute to me lately. How is he tasting these days?
You are never a good friend.
You could have anybody that you want.
Why Chip?
You're killing people.
No, I'm killing boys.
I'm scared.
I thought you only murdered boys.
I go both ways.
Anita Needy Lesnicki, once an insecure teenager, now a violent mental inmate, who starts the story with a flashback while in solitary confinement. Needy is nicknamed Kicker in the asylum, as she is notorious for kicking anyone, from guards to doctors, at the slightest provocation. Needy used to stay in a small town called Devil's Kettle, named after a waterfall. Needy and popular cheerleader Jennifer Check have been best friends since childhood, despite having little in common. Needy is a dork and Jennifer is uber hot. Needy is dating her boyfriend Chip, and they are a completely normal couple. One night, Jennifer takes Needy to a local dive bar to attend a concert by indie rock band Low Shoulder, who has come from the city. Jennifer has a crush on the lead singer, Nikolai, and offers to get him a drink. Needy overhears Nikolai talking to his band member, trying to guess if Jennifer is a virgin. Needy confronts Nikolai and confirms that Jennifer is a virgin and stays that way by ignoring creeps like Nikolai.
I think the lead singer wants me.
Only because he thinks that you're a virgin. I heard them talking.
What? I'm not even a backdoor virgin.
A suspicious fire engulfs the bar, killing several people. And Jennifer agrees to leave with the band despite Needy's attempts to stop her. Later that evening, Jennifer, covered in blood, appears in Needy's kitchen and proceeds to eat food from the refrigerator. Unable to digest the matter, she vomits a trail of black spiny fluid and almost bites Needy's neck, and then leaves in a hurry as Needy calls after her. Needy spends the entire night cleaning her kitchen floor. The next morning at school, Jennifer appears fine and shrugs off Needy's concerns. While the small town is devastated by the 8 deaths caused by the fire, Jennifer seduces the school's football captain, Jonas, in the woods and then attacks him. Jonas's disemboweled corpse is later found. Meanwhile, Lil Shoulder gains popularity due to their rumored heroism during the fire and offers to make a charity appearance at the school's spring formal. No thanks. A month later, Jennifer is beginning to look pale and accepts a date with school goth punk Colin, whom she brutally kills that night. Needy senses something dreadful has happened and has a disturbing vision of demonic Jennifer. After making it home, Needy finds a revitalized and amorous Jennifer in her bed. Jennifer attempts to seduce Needy by kissing her. Needy initially reciprocates, but then comes to her senses and demands an explanation.
What do you want from me?
I just want to explain some things to you. Besides, best friends don't keep secrets, right?
Jennifer explains that after the fire, Low Shoulder took her into the woods and offered her as a virgin sacrifice to Satan himself in exchange for their fame and fortune. However, although the sacrifice and greedy exchange were a success, Jennifer was not a virgin. And when the lead singer Nikolai murdered her, a demonic spirit took over her body. Jennifer reveals that she knows she needs human flesh and blood to survive. She had intended to eat Needy as well, but left because she could not bring herself to hurt her best friend. When she's eaten, she can withstand virtually any injury without pain. Basically a superhero. The next day at school, as the town is stunned by Colin's death, Needy goes to the school library occult section and surmises that Jennifer is a succubus. She is weakest when she's hungry and must eat flesh in order to sustain her life and appearance. Needy tells Chip about her discoveries and warns him not to attend the dance.
Jennifer's evil.
I know.
No, I mean, she's actually evil. Not high school evil.
He doesn't believe her, and she breaks up with him to try to protect him. Chip goes to the dance, hoping to meet with Needy, but instead is intercepted by Jennifer, who seduces him and takes him to an abandoned pool house. Needy arrives there and finds Jennifer feeding on Chip. Jennifer escapes while Needy, heartbroken, watches her boyfriend die. Needy then decides that she must kill Jennifer. Angry and heartbroken, Needy breaks into Jennifer's bedroom. The two fight, and Jennifer bites Needy's shoulder in the struggle. Needy rips Jennifer's best friend necklace off her neck. Jennifer stops fighting back, and Needy stabs her in the heart with a utility knife.
My dad. No. Your heart.
Killing her and destroying the demon. Soon after, Needy's brought to an asylum. Since she was scratched by Jennifer, she has some of Jennifer's supernatural powers. Set upon revenge for what was done to Jennifer and herself, she escapes the mental facility and hitchhikes a ride to the hotel where the band, Low Shoulder, is staying. We assume she kills them all.
But sometimes change can be good. For instance, most occult scholars don't know this, but if you're bitten by a demon and you live, you just might absorb some of the demon's abilities.
You just might get lucky for once in your miserable life.
So now it's time to talk horror, and my guest today is Dragan Grimm. He is a author and podcaster. So what are you working on?
Well, right now I've got the second book in my Doomphage series. It's basically, I kind of describe it as Goosebumps for grown-ups. Basically, it's kind of that format, that style, but basically where all the really kind of cool stuff would happen off the page in Goosebumps, because it's meant for young readers. Well, it happens on the page in mine. So if you grew up with that kind of thing, it feels like maybe it grew up with you. And if you haven't, and you're just kind of maybe familiar with the style, it kind of almost feels like old kind of horror movies that we used to kind of rent back in the day, back in the 80s and 90s, just kind of like as a book. I was one of those kids who would always go to the video store on the weekends and rent like just kind of B-movie horror. So these books are essentially the movies I kind of grew up watching and the movies that I wish I could make. But, you know, I don't have a production budget. So I just have a computer and Word. So I just basically write them out like these cool little horror novellas.
So where can people find you?
You can find me at grimthrall.com or Grimthrall on Instagram and X and Blue Sky. I've recently just joined Threads because that's what like all the cool kids are doing now. So basically anywhere and everywhere with social media, just look for Grimthrall and you will find me there.
Perfect. So today we're here to talk about Jennifer's Body, and you were interested in this one because it's a monster movie.
It's a monster movie, but as all really, really good monster movies, or the best ones, they're kind of, it's an allegory. It's a metaphor for something else, and it's a metaphor for something that is very much rooted in human psychology. And I always feel like those are the best monster movies, because monsters are essentially, I feel, in mythology, were created to either represent things bigger than us that we don't understand, or things within us that we don't necessarily understand. And I feel like this film very much fits within the latter category.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. So that kind of gets us into the themes. So this movie starts out and, you know, you've got Jennifer and you've got Needy. And it's this very codependent friendship. You would think that Needy is the needy one, but I think Jennifer's also very needy.
Oh, yes. I would say she is more the needy one, interestingly enough, using needy much more as a crutch.
Mm-hmm. Having her ego kind of stroked.
She yeah.
constantly needs that affirmation. And we'll get more into it towards like the end of the movie, but you really get to see it towards the end when they have a big conflict between the two of them.
Right off the bat, again, I'd seen this movie when it first came out in theaters, then I would kind of see it kind of sporadically over the years, but it had been kind of a minute since the last, I think it probably been about a good 6-7 years since the last time I watched it. Mm-hmm. So revisiting it now kind of with fresh eyes and being a little bit older, I was right away like, because since that time, you know, you have more people coming out of your life, you grow as a person. So I was already picking up on things that now, like, oh, that reminds me of such and such. That reminds me of someone you know. And Jennifer, pretty much from the beginning, you realize what a very fragile ego she is, because the movie was billed as like, you know, she's a popular girl, she's the cool one, she's kind of the queen of the school, and you realize that pretty quickly that she's essentially a pane of glass, and that, like you said, that codependent relationship is very much like, you know, she is being supported by me, like without her, like the facade, that, you know, that classic shot that was in all the trailers of her walking down the hall, yeah. You know, that is made only possible because of this relationship.
You know, this movie deals a lot with like teenage angst and coming of age type stuff, especially for women. There's a lot of exploration between gender roles, and they kind of flip the gender roles on their head, which I really enjoy, because the men actually end up being super sensitive in this film.
Yes, it's nice to see, because, you know, contrary to popular belief, you know, us guys, we're not as, you know, stoic and stone cold as I think media A portrays us to be, or we're kind of brought up to be. I think now it's changing a lot more, but I know, speaking for myself, when I was growing up, you know, I was very much of that generation, boys don't cry, you got to be tough, this and that. So when I see like this big linebacker in the film just like tearing up, it was, you know, it was kind of refreshing, because again, it was nice, like, oh, you know, growing up, I wish I would have been encouraged to do that. So it's played a little bit for laughs, but at the same time, there's always that subtext of like, you know, this is how it actually is versus how it's supposed to be. So yeah, I think this film does a really good job of kind of casting a light on that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a horror comedy, so they kind of amp up the, like, the comedy piece, make everything a little bit extra ridiculous, but it is also commentary on social structures and things that, especially coming of age, like teenagers have to deal with. It's more a film about the teenage experience than anything else. I actually didn't see it when it came out, though. I think you're one of the few people that actually did, because this movie was a big flop.
Yeah, I remember that, which is interesting, because it was hyped up. If I remember correctly, it was hyped up pretty significantly. I think this is obviously kind of, I feel like, at the height of Megan Fox's popularity. I remember when it was coming out, everyone was talking about, you know, Megan Fox is going to be in a horror movie, and, you know, me being, you know, a horror movie guy, and, you know, full disclosure, finding Megan Fox very attractive to me, I was like, day one, I'm there. So
everyone finds her attractive. If you don't find her attractive, there's something wrong with you.
No, I agree. And I tell people, I mean, and again, I know she's caught a lot of flack from some people over the years, but I actually always kind of found her, yeah, she's attractive in the kind of classical sense, but I always kind of felt she had a bit of an old Hollywood kind of look to her too. So, and I actually, I've seen her even now, and I actually think she's honestly more stunning now than ever. But yeah, no, I guess, so me and my group of friends, we were all kind of excited for this movie. So I was actually kind of surprised after the fact when I heard they didn't do well, because I was kind of like, what, why? You know, it's so, yeah. But yeah, you're right. I guess me and my friends were pretty much the only people who went and saw it, I guess.
So I guess the first kind of theme I wanted to jump into was about female sexuality and the male gaze. So yeah. That is a huge component of this movie. There's a lot of focus on virginity and the importance of virginity. And the film subverts traditional horror tropes by portraying a female character, Jennifer, as a monstrous figure, but ultimately it critiques how female sexuality is often objectified and controlled by the male gaze. The movie explores how women are often portrayed as monsters when they embrace their sexuality, and how female characters are victims of male violence and exploitation. And you kind of get that straight off in the beginning of the movie when they go to see the band. Needy overhears the band guys talking about if she's a virgin or not. And their conversation is very interesting, because between the band guys, like, the lead singer is the only one that believes she could be a virgin.
Yeah.
He's like, I know this kind of girl. She's the kind of girl that is going to like flaunt it, but she's not going to give it up for anyone.
Right.
And they're like, I don't know about that. Like, she kind of looks like a slut.
Yeah, neither one of them are him versus the rest of the band. They're both kind of playing into like kind of opposing stereotypes, or either these singers are just kind of like, again, like the, you know, the groupie who just kind of wants to just be a tease. Essentially, the singer is a tease.
Yeah.
And the other band are just like, well, she's just kind of, you know, it's almost like you're pulling into port and here is, you know, the whore, essentially. But none of them are ever, at no point do they entertain the fact that she's a person, she's a girl. They don't just see her as a fan. Like, well, maybe she just likes your music. Maybe she's just happy you're here. It's like, no, they're right away, they're objectifying her or just kind of reducing her to like a type, a stereotype that, you know, whereas if that had been a guy that came up to them, obviously they probably would have been interested, but they would have still just seen, oh, he must be a fan.
You see in this movie how the, especially females at shows, are immediately targets of like the male gaze. And then when it comes to the whole virginity thing, I mean, it was kind of crucial that she was a virgin so that they could sacrifice her.
Right.
But that whole thing in itself, like having to be a virgin to be sacrificed, like if you are not a virgin, for some reason, you're not worth sacrificing.
Yeah. Like for some reason, like, you know, some, you know, hellbound fiend would look upon you as less than, like a creature from like this abysmal place that is condemned to damnation would still be on a high horse looking down like, look, you know, I know I live in a pit of hell, but you know, you've had sex, so ew. So it's almost like, it's almost reducing a woman to something even lower than that, like, you know, you're not even good enough for the devil, you know, this thing in Judeo-Christian mythology that we have kind of epitomized as like the worst of the worst, and yet technically in a weird way you're worse than that because even they wouldn't want you.
Yeah,
just because you've, you know, you've come into your own, you've embraced your sexuality. Whereas if it had been a guy, well, first of all, a guy would never be sacrificed. But, you know, again, it's the whole thing of like, if a man is having sex, it's just, you know, you're sowing your wild oats. But if a woman has sex, you are now, you're impure, you're violated, you're tainted in some capacity.
Yeah, you're not worth sacrificing anymore.
Exactly. Which, I mean, I guess that'd be a good thing in this case, but it's still kind of like, well, what really? Like, why? Just because I had sex and now that's this terrible thing. And yet men are always pressuring women to have sex. And then once they do it, they are kind of now ridiculed and scorned for it. So it's like, there's no winning, basically, it seems.
Yeah, no, 100%. I thought it was really funny that Needy knew that Jennifer wasn't a virgin, that when they're talking, she thinks that they're talking shit. She's like, she is a virgin.
Yeah.
She tells them, so they start lying and saying that she's a virgin to like defend her. But if anything, it made it worse.
It sealed her fate. Which of course you have no way of knowing that, but it is kind of the irony where if she would have just, she would have been better off going up and say, oh yeah, she's a total slut, you know.
Yeah.
You know, town whore over here. That would have ironically enough saved her life, but of course that's her friend, so she is trying to defend her friend's kind of honor, which is I think that right off the bat is like your first kind of indication of like, okay, here's the real problem. It's like if it was a guy, you know, who was that promiscuous, it'd be, you know, high fives all around the bar.
Yeah,
you know, no one would be saying, oh, my buddy here, he's a virgin. Everyone would be like, are you virgin? No, they'd be lying in the opposite way. Are you kidding me? He's banged half the school. It'd be
that's no, that's a good point. Like if it was a guy, they would be lying that he isn't a virgin.
Yeah, it'd be like, oh yeah, you know, he's got a, you know, 12-inch dick, man. He usually hear the stories they say. Again, it really would be like the exaggeration to the opposite degree. He would be a stud, whereas with Jennifer, she has to be Mother Teresa, she has to be a nun, she has to be untouched, which when you hear them kind of in the kind of, they both seem unrealistic. They usually, the truth kind of falls in the middle.
I love her her quote too, when she says, I'm not even a backdoor virgin.
Yeah. I'm like, I'd say like in a bag of like peas or something next day. But oh, by the way, real quick sidebar, did you clock who the deputy in training was?
Yeah, it was, what's his fucking name, that was
Chris Pratt.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, I completely forgot. I think this would have been before Parks and Rec and obviously before Guardians of the Galaxy and everything. So when I saw, I was, oh my god, that's Chris Pratt. So
but
again, even his character was very much playing into like that kind of small town, which I've lived in small towns like that, so I've known that guy, I've seen that guy. Like when the course when the band takes the stage and the eyeliners and he's like, what a bunch of fagos, it's like I knew that guy, you know. Yeah. I mean, these guys just have just barely any eyeliner on. But right away, you know, the small town like gummers, as she calls them, are immediately like just, you know, just, again, stereotypes. It's like, oh, these guys must be this, they must be that, because they look a certain way, because they present themselves in a certain way. Therefore, I already know everything and anything I need to know about them.
And I find it interesting, too, when she's about to be sacrificed and she realizes, like, oh, shit, they're going to stab me. She, again, emphasizes the fact that she's a virgin. She's like, I'm a virgin, though. I'm a virgin. For some reason, she thinks that's going to save her. Like, if she's pure, she think in her mind, I'm guessing that she thinks if she is innocent,
yeah,
that they will feel bad for her, as opposed to like, no one cares if the whore dies.
Right.
It's the messaging that's all around you. It's the, you know, it's the culture that, especially if you're American, that you grew up with.
It's weird because my family's French. So when I would go visit my family in France, it's the opposite. Like over there, like so many of the things that Americans get made fun of so much over there for this kind of thing. Like they do not understand at all what this kind of obsession, or like why sex and nudity and all this is considered so taboo. Because to them, it's like it's natural. So a lot of it really does feel like it is a kind of a snapshot into like what it is like to grow up in America, what it is like to be young in America.
Yeah. I like, we'll get more into like the sacrifice and stuff, but that whole sequence of events was just hilarious, the way that they went about it when they were like singing to her to like almost like calm her down.
Yeah.
Before they murdered her.
Yeah. It's okay, sweetie. It's fine. It's fine. Yeah. We're going to gut you like a fish, but just relax. Almost speaking like a child, like they're reducing her in that moment where it's, you're not even allowing her to justify her own feelings about what it is you're doing to her, which is just, it's almost like a point you're just, it's just insult to injury, really.
So with Needy, I'm pretty sure she was a virgin, because he's like, am I hurting you? Am I too big? Like, it was definitely their first time having sex. It was so fucking awkward.
Yeah.
It wasn't sexy at all.
But that was nice to do that, because how many times have we watched a movie where it's like, it's my first time, when the music swells and you have the warm lighting and these, see, their back is arching, and it's, and I'm like, it is not like that. Even for the guy, it's not like that the first time. We are not these, you know, like trashy romance novel cover studs.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, maybe if someone out there listening, you are good for you. I'm just speaking for myself. Like I was, you know, I was not hot shit. Like it was a learning experience for everyone involved.
Yeah, no, it's so awkward. It is so, I think, I don't, realistically, the first time you have sex is going to be extremely awkward. It's the first time you're like naked in front of someone that you, it's just weird. It's just weird.
It's not like at the locker room or the chain room where it's like, no, we're naked and we're about to do the most intimate thing possible. Whereas if you're at least like getting changed in the locker room, the guy's like, hey, yeah, we're naked, but it's like, whatever, we're just changing. It's not a big deal. We're just, you know, but it's like, no, this is a big deal, because we're going to do the thing. When he was putting on the condom, the way he kind of looked at, it's like, yes, that's exactly how it is.
Yeah.
It's almost, look, if you were watching it yourself, you'd be laughing and cringing, because it's just so ridiculous. Once you're in the moment, you're in the moment. But when you step out of, you're like, this is, We look stupid right now. What's going on?
Definitely just like, get this over with type thing. She's not against it by any means, but it's like, losing your virginity for a woman is not this amazing experience.
Yeah.
It's really fucking uncomfortable. And
so I've been told,
I think that is portrayed very well in this movie.
Yeah, because I mean, granted, a lot of her discovery is coming from like the vision, but I think that's also supposed to be a bit of more of like a metaphor for what it is like. For again, I'm not speaking like I know, but from again what I've been told, what I've seen, it's like yes. I mean, for a guy, it's, even if it's not going to be great for our first time, you know, as long as, you know, I mean, we're men. As long as you get enough friction going, you know, a wall or a pillowcase gets the job done. Whereas for a woman, it's a much more, I feel, personal experience. So yeah, I feel for, you know, for losing your virginity as a woman. Again, I had a couple friends in high school. They even said too, like, you know, they did. I was like, well, how was it? Like, hey, I wasn't very good, but at least I've done it now. And it always felt like that was the attitude. Like, yeah, the guy is going to get something out of it. So it is a very different experience, which I also think is why men are usually so much more, come on, let's go, let's do it. Because even him in the film, he was a really nice guy. Yeah. Very understanding. But it was still him always kind of initiating it. It was still him kind of always not pushing it. He was nice about it, but he was still like, oh, I bought some condoms.
So the next theme I wanted to talk about is the teenage angst and pressure to conform. The film delves into the complexities of high school life, focusing on the struggles of Needy and Jennifer as they navigate the pressures of popularity, friendship, and social expectations. The film explores the raw and repressed sides of queer teenagehood. And then the music is very representative of the teenage experience at this time, and an integral part of the movie as well. So I kind of wanted to get into their friendship dynamic a little bit here. Jennifer is like the popular girl, cheerleader. She was, what, Snow Queen 2 years ago?
Yeah. Type
thing. that's like a whole funny dialogue on itself. And even in the beginning, there's like the dialogue where Needy is, she's narrating the beginning of the story. And she talks about how people don't understand why Jennifer would be friends with such a dorky girl like her.
Yeah. And again, I think right away that is setting up kind of like the power dynamic in their friendship, because it's a question that kind of answers itself, I think, pretty quickly.
Yeah. And there is a very queer side to the movie. Like, Needy, she's definitely crushing on Jennifer. And Jennifer is also, she flirts back with it. Like, she, like, Jennifer is not welcoming to the boyfriend, kind of teasing him and taunting him, and like tries to get him to kind of go away because she wants Needy for herself. And there's even that beginning scene where they're like pushing each other. They're about to go to the show and they're playfully pushing. And then she just does it, like Jennifer does it a little too hard, and it becomes almost sexual. But, you know, that dynamic continues throughout the film until eventually it culminates in their making out scene. And apparently that scene was a lot more graphic. They were planning on it being a lot more graphic, but they, when it came to the ratings and stuff and the plot, they were like, no, we need to take this back. And so they cut out a bunch.
Yeah, which was saying a lot, because, you know, again, you don't see a lot. It's not like they strip naked or anything, but I was even the close up of the kiss, and they, in fact, they just linger, and you basically see it isn't, because it almost shows you the progression of their relationship in that one moment where it's first it's timid, and then you see the tongues, and I'm just like, it's so graphic, but it very much kind of, it's almost showing you like kind of that sexual repression kind of being released, where it starts off as you're not sure, you're timid, but as the longer it goes on, the more you can see they want it. I guess my only question was, how much of that is Jennifer legitimately wanting it versus Jennifer using sex as a weapon? Because you see kind of throughout the school, she's using her femininity or sexuality to control
people.
So it doesn't necessarily feel like, oh, I like sex, I'm enjoying sex. This is how I have power. This is how I get my way. This is how I can control people, is with my body. You know, the title, the name. Whereas, because you see, even going back when at the club, when she meets Low Shoulder, the second she's kind of talking to people who are kind of outside of this bubble, outside of this pond, she immediately kind of shows you almost like her insecurity and kind of her inexperience, what she's talking with them. She's awkward. She almost becomes like a real teenage girl in that moment. Whereas all the other guys in that bar, she's, you know, she owns the room. Mm-hmm. And she even says something at one point where she was saying, like, I wish there were more guys like that here in Devil's Kettle. She never talks about leaving, going anywhere. It's always like she wants everything to come to her, because this is where she feels like she's in control. So when she's doing that with Needy, I mean, yes, I think there is definitely some exploration on her part sexually, but I also got the sense that for her, it was more of a power play.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think she definitely, because at first Needy was telling her to leave.
Yeah.
And then her response is, instead of leaving, well, how about I make out with you? And, so it definitely was a play on, using her sexuality to empower herself and to get her way. She also, in the beginning of the movie, when they're at the bar, she tells Needy that she needs to use, she like grabs her boobs and she's like, these are like bombs, like just point them in the right direction
Yep.
and you'll get whatever you want.
Yep.
So her, like, she's very explicit about the fact that she uses her sexuality to get what she wants. Like, she wants to even buy drinks for the guys of the for the band. And so she goes over and she's like, I can't remember exactly what she's saying, but basically she's alluding to the fact that she's going to use her breasts.
She says, I'll just play Hello Titty with the bartender.
Yeah. Whatever that game is. I don't even know what that game
I don't know
is,
what that is
but
either, but I'm like, I mean, I can imagine, but it also speaks, this is something I kind of actually wanted to really touch upon because, I mean, even before she becomes like a succubus or, well, I believe that's the kind of demon they're alluding that what she is. I feel like in our society, like if you're considered attractive in the conventional sense, and I by no means think that to be attractive, you have to just look like that. But in our society, that is kind of the cover girl, the Cosmo, your Hollywood starlet look, which not surprisingly why Megan Fox became so popular because she had that look. But I feel like girls like that are also taught to like, you don't need to be smart. You don't need to be talented. You don't need to be good at really anything. You're pretty. Therefore, because for all we know, Jennifer could have been incredibly intelligent. She could have had other attributes, but she was never allowed, or rather, never allowed herself to explore any of these other facets of herself because I look a certain way. Therefore, this is all I'm good for is to be eye candy. Whereas someone like Needy, even though Needy I think is incredibly attractive, I think they did
Oh
the
yeah,
whole
she's beautiful.
that whole Hollywood trope. Like, we're gonna take an incredibly stunning young woman and put glasses on her because that'll hide the fact. It's like the whole Rachel Lee Cook thing, and she's all that. Where we're looking at her, I'm like, well, she's hot now, so all you did was make it so she can't see as well when she takes off her glasses. But I'm not seeing, an upgrade or a downgrade. But it's that very much thing. Well, but in context of this film, you're not the pretty one, therefore, of course, you're smart because you need to lean on something else.
Another part of like the queer theme. So throughout the film, Needy leaves clues about her attraction to Jennifer. Needy ends up killing Jennifer, but she feels guilty about it. And she wants to avenge Jennifer's death. So it's this, I lost the person that I love. I need to go make this right. So there's that in it in the movie. And then the reason why Needy is Chip's girlfriend is because the production wanted to emphasize the exploration and sexual discovery that's experienced in adolescence, kind of like what you were talking about. Like, even if it turned out that she was a lesbian, she feels like she has to be with a guy. So she's at least exploring that. Even the sex scene between Needy and Chip is made on purpose as a metaphor that she doesn't enjoy it quite the opposite to when she has her first lesbian encounter with Jennifer, which those two moments really do kind of mirror each other, and she's like obviously into it with Jennifer. And
Almost to the
then
point
with
where so
Chip,
much.
it's like the awkward thing.
Yeah. Well, when she has her experience with Jennifer, and she at one point almost takes the lead. I mean, yes, Jennifer initiates it, gets it going, but then she go gets on top, and it's kind of the first time in the film where you really see her kind of assert herself in any real way. Again, it doesn't go very far because she kind of like snaps out of like, what the fuck is going on? But you see her give into it and take the lead, take control, and Jennifer's like, okay, letting it happen. And that's really the only time in the film, other than the very end, where you kind of see her do that, where in that moment she's like, yes, this feels right. This is comfortable. I want this. I'm going to do this. This isn't something that is happening to me. This is something that was offered to me, and I'm taking it for myself. So,
The other theme that's connected to this is revenge and justice. So the film can be interpreted as a comedic horror revenge story, with Jennifer taking revenge on the symbols of male violence and exploitation. The film explores the idea of a woman gaining power and serving justice after being violated. So once she becomes this succubus creature, she's not killing, she could kill anyone and gain her power. Like she just, she has to feed. But she could feed on anyone. She could have feeded on Needy, and she even admits that she wanted to. Like she was so hungry when she went and saw Needy that night. And she like puked all the black stuff and everything. But she fought against the urge because she didn't want revenge against Needy. She didn't want to hurt her. So she starts picking off all these guys.
And it is interesting because she is very almost non-discriminate with the guys that she chooses. But again, it is almost still kind of when she kills the linebacker, you almost feel like, okay, that's the guy she would normally go for when she was pop that again, football player. But I forget his name, but the emo character, it is interesting because when he shows interest in her, it's almost you see her when it's in one of those moments where she's kind of coming down off of it and she looks like bedraggled and everything.
It's funny too, with I think his name was Colin, is the one that wanted, he like asked her to the Rocky Horror Picture Show, and she's like, I can't remember what she
I
says,
don't
but
like
she doesn't
boxing
know what the Rocky Horror Picture Show is.
because she thought it was just a Rocky movie. And
Yeah.
I could see the look on his face like it's not a fucking.
He was very vulnerable in that house. And he, like, that was also one of those moments of male vulnerability where she is playing on his fear. And she even says to him, like, she has him alone. And she's like, I want you to be scared. I need you to be scared. And he realizes, like, oh shit, like, I'm going to be devoured. And does she, is that the, I think that's when she's like, I'm going to eat your soul or something.
Something like that, yeah. Because she does the thing with her eyes, and it's like, yeah, that's what she kind of likes, kind of drops the facade a little bit. But it is interesting because I mean, she is a literal predator in the movie, but it almost feels like a sexual predator where you're going to take someone that you have more power, you are physically more power than, you're going to lure them somewhere where they're cut off from any kind of help, and they're going to be completely at your mercy. And that whole scene, it very much feels it's essentially just a metaphor for sexual assault.
So when it came to Chip, Needy broke up with Chip because she wanted to protect him. She's like, it's not safe for you to be dating me right now. And she tells him, like, Jennifer's evil. And I'm not talking about like high school girl evil. Like, she's really evil. Like, she's eating boys. And he doesn't believe her. He thinks she's insane. And he is actually, he receives pepper spray. I can't remember who gave him the pepper spray. I think it
I think
was,
it was his mom.
I think it
Which
was the mom. And but that was a funny moment too, because women are essentially like, girls are the ones who are given the pepper spray to be safe, and then he's given the pepper spray.
Well, I think it's interesting too because again, as a mother, a woman, she would instinctively be kind of when she think about people going out on dates, she that's something as a woman you think more of. Like she said, her mind's like, okay, yes, she has a son, but it's still she's still thinking of like, okay, there is inherent risk when you go out.
There's definitely a false sense of security when it comes to being a guy in society and thinking, that you're not vulnerable the way that women are very aware of their vulnerability in society. Yeah, I think that's the crux of the male vulnerability here. Like the Yeah, they end up being the prey, and Jennifer is, I really see it as her getting revenge on men because she could kill anyone, but she doesn't choose to.
Because yeah, I think in mythology, succubus, they it's like it's like reproductive fluid they need to feed off of, whereas in this movie, you see her just like drinking blood. It's
Yeah.
more so it's again, she really much just feels like, I mean, she might as well just be like a werewolf or a vampire in this movie. Really, it'd be the same thing. She's just literally just eating you. So
Yeah.
her doing with men, it really that is a choice. It's no longer like, well, she can only like no, she could, like you said, she could kill and eat, absolutely anyone. Probably doesn't even have to be human. It's just, I think she, at this point, she's just a big carnivore. So yeah, but the fact that she is targeting specifically men, that is her. Because I don't really think the movie goes into it, like how the relationship with her and the demon work. Is she the demon? Is the demon like a parasite where it's controlling her? How much is what? Because I think like the instinct is demonic, but the personality is still her. So her choosing men, that's Jennifer. That's not the demon. The demon's just like, throw meat down my your gullet. That's all I care about. I don't care. Dogs, cats, kids, girls, I don't care. Whereas, so yeah, the fact that it's her, well, I'm only going to go after them. That is her personality.
Yeah.
Coming out of that repressed anger and resentment that is manifesting itself, and that kind of demonic instinct is now kind of like empowering her, making her feel like, well, I can now do this and I'm going to do this and no one can stop me from doing it.
Yeah. That kind of gets me into the next theme, which is demonic femininity. The film explores the idea of demonic femininity with Jennifer becoming a demonic figure after being possessed. So she is possessed. She's alive. And she's the host for this demon succubus thing. And the film explores the consequences of this transformation. So the demon that possesses Jennifer closely resembles a succubus or succubi from Jewish, Christian, and Sumerian mythology. It is said that succubi seduce men and fornicate with them until they are drained. In the movie, getting drained could mean getting drained of your blood instead of semen. So some possible examples of succubi are Lilitu from Sumerian mythology, Lilin, and then Lilith, both from Jewish mythology. I kind of get into Lilith and things like that and talking about those figures as demons. They're actually seen as feminist. So some Jewish feminists view Lilith as the first feminist due to her defiance of patriarchal, I think I said that right, structures. Some view Lilith as a symbol for female power and independence, while others see her as a destructive force. I see her as a powerful being, that she is a feminist. That's how I view her. What about you?
I mean, same. And I think that is now becoming the more prevalent view of her. Because again, it very much, traditionally it was always like, okay, well, it is a woman who is defiant, therefore bad. You know, I believe she's considered like the mother of demons too. I think that's one of, like, she knows, which also demons, demonic, it's bad. She made them. Well, demons are essentially fallen angels because they rebel. But again, it's very much this idea like, well, she had the audacity to just say no. You know, she didn't do anything really beyond that. But traditionally, that was bad enough. Whereas I feel like, yeah, now it makes sense. Like, well, what is, again, her crime was just kind of sticking up for herself.
Yeah.
And she was, you know, again, literally demonized. She said no. And that in and of itself was significant, you know. But again, it just goes to show you kind of the changing times, is what she did, her crime, has never really changed throughout the retellings. It's just our interpretation as a society of what that means to us, what that decision means to us. That's that refusal to adherence, again, once upon a time was deemed awful. And now people are realizing like, well, no, that's what you should do.
Yeah. No, I did some research into like the demons and things like that, and what I guess like a Lilin demon is a follower of Lilith. And then the Lilitu or Lilite came before Lilith. So it was like a predecessor of Lilith. Basically, Lilith is a ripoff of Lilith. If I'm wrong, people, you can email me and let me know that I'm wrong. But
how dare you research, hear all those things typing now?
That's what I saw.
Well, you know, because there's a lot of stuff in the Bible, especially like Old Testament, where it can be traced back to earlier belief systems. Yeah. Like, so, I mean, that makes sense because, yeah, you know, so it doesn't surprise me that that story is kind of like a, probably a take on a much older one.
Yeah. Well, Lilith too is in the Sumerian and Akkadian mythology. So that came before.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, because I know there's a few other stories that you can find in the Old Testament that you can trace back to parts of the Middle East. So yeah, and it makes sense. It's, again, it's like a carryover from that.
Yeah. Even the low shoulder band members, they all had crescent moon tattoos.
Yeah.
And they performed the ritual sacrifice of Jennifer on the night of a crescent moon. Is a crescent moon? I thought a full moon was the powerful moon. Like,
I wasn't sure if that was actually based on anything or they were just trying to be subversive. Like, hey, everyone does a full moon, or maybe people associate like a full moon with like a werewolf. So to differentiate between a, because again, the fact that she does take on more bestial traits, I don't know if maybe they wanted to really not get people confused. Like, no, she's not a werewolf. She's something else.
I guess the only other thing I wanted, like scene I wanted to talk about was the, with the pool, the rec center that was abandoned. And I don't know why Chip goes with Jennifer. Honestly, like he didn't like her. There's no chemistry. Like he just seems so confused the whole time, but somehow he goes with it still.
Well, that's what I was kind of wondering. Does she doesn't have like any other power, right? Like she doesn't have like any kind of mind control power. Like because up to that point I felt like, well, it's still just Jennifer seducing men with her looks. And again, the demonic power is purely just bestial in nature. It's just I'm now stronger, faster, I've got claws and teeth. I never at any point thought there was any kind of like psychic power, because it almost like he's in a trance at that point. Like he's
following her around, and he's like, all right, let me go into this abandoned rec center with you. And that water was so fucking disgusting. I mean, I was just cringing the entire time. I'm like, ew, they're in it. They're in that water. Yeah, it's like, so gross.
Like, I don't care if she turns into a monster. I don't care if she eviscerates him or cuts his head off, whatever. Don't go in the water. Just don't, because even if you somehow survive her, you're gonna die of God knows how many diseases and parasites after going in that
one. Oh, so gross. I think that was the worst, like watching them just covered in like the muck. I'm like, ugh.
This I know that was
ski. Like, don't go in there.
I was at that point, I would be like, yes, kill me. It's a mercy killing because I'm afraid what's going to start falling off of me once I get out of the pool. It's like gangrene, tetanus, just.
It was a literal cesspool.
Yeah, and literally, that's what I'm saying. Like, I mean, when I saw that, I was like, oh, God, like, don't go. Because I get grossed out with stuff like that in movies. Like, you can, you know, I'll watch like the Terrifier movies and not bat an eye at it, but like, you know, someone does anything unsanitary and I'm just like, oh no, wash your hands, please go take a shower.
Yeah, like, can you please not do that? That's so gross.
Yeah,
kill him in a clean area, please.
Yes, please. Let's be, you know, we don't have to be savages about this, come on now.
Yeah. And when it comes to that scene, like, I felt like Jennifer only really targeted Chip because it was a way to control Needy.
Yeah.
And their conflict within that scene was so epic. Like, then that's when they really, you saw that friendship dynamic kind of crumble and how they supported each other. So like, she starts flying out and Needy's like, it's not that impressive, she's just levitating. And then Jennifer's like, you're just always have to undermine me, like, you're such a bitch type thing.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That the beauty of that scene is that you could remove all the supernatural elements and just put that like in a straight teen drama.
Yeah.
And just, you know, replace the whole line about levitating with something else. And it would play out the exact same way. Like, the supernatural elements are not even really what matters. It's like you said, it's the crumbling of their friendship. It's not a matter of like, I have to go fight a monster now. It's like, no. I have to break up with my best friend. The fact that she's a demon is besides the point. So it's almost like all the supernatural stuff at the climax of the movie, which, you know, normally what you pay to see. It's like, okay, here we go. Now here's the horror part of the movie, all this, you know, the fantastical stuff. And it's almost like at that point, it's besides the point. It doesn't matter. It's not what the movie's about. It's about Needy finally getting out from under Jennifer. Mm-hmm. It's about saying, you know, I'm not going to be your lapdog anymore. I'm not going to just be here to make you feel good anymore. And I feel like that would have been a confrontation that would have happened anyway.
And then when she goes to kill her at the end, she's like, it's another one of those, you know, moments that's like commenting on the queer themes whenever she has the, what, it's not a knife, it's like a tool. It's like a razor blade or something.
Oh, it's like a box cutter.
Yeah, it's a box
cutter. Oh, yeah, because they even make that joke about it, like, oh, you know, the box cutter thing. I'm like, ha, 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 ha. Yeah, yeah.
She's like, do you get all your murder weapons from Home Depot? Yeah. Some Butch. And she, like, calls her Butch.
Yeah.
And then, again, like, Jennifer is emphasizing her body whenever she kills her. So she stabs her in the heart. But Jennifer's like, my tit.
Yeah.
And Needy's like, no, your heart. I am stabbing your heart, not your tit.
Yeah. Well, again, it's showing them like right up to the end, like they are who they are. And again, I like that.
And I love it too. I think it's a deleted scene, but when she's like, you're killing people. And Jennifer says, no, I'm killing boys. I think the only other thing I wanted to talk about was, which this is very much the female experience, so I'm sorry if I'm making you uncomfortable.
Oh, no, okay. Go for it.
You know, this succubus is literally sucking her dry. Like, yeah. She has to kill to regain her powers, and it's like once a month, right? Once a month she has to kill.
Yeah.
So that she can regain her strength. She's like, PMS isn't real, Needy. It's just something made up by the media to make us feel like we're crazy, to make women look like they're crazy.
Yeah.
Which I was like, yes, go off. Like, yes.
You know, I've had that conversation before. And again, I don't pretend to be an expert by any stretch of the imagination. So I always just kind of allow myself to be educated in those moments. I'm like, well, tell me more, because I'm certainly not going to tell you anything.
So I think we pretty much discussed it all. So this movie has some really good lines in it.
Yes.
It is hilarious. So I have a little game where it's called Whose Line Is It? So it could either be Jennifer or Needy.
Okay.
And I try to pick very like ambiguous lines that they both have said. So I'm going to give you a line and you're going to tell me if it was Jennifer or Needy.
Okay.
All right. Hell is a teenage girl.
Needy.
Yes. Yes. That was Needy at the beginning of the movie when she was talking to Chip.
Yes. Yeah. Because I remember it was towards the beginning.
Yeah. What's wrong with you besides the obvious surface flaws?
Jennifer, because when I heard that, I was like, oh my God, that is the most mean-spirited thing in this entire movie. How their friend did not, how she didn't stick a box cutter in Jennifer's chest right then and there. That was the meanest thing
It was so bitchy. I want to use that. I need to use that. What's wrong with you besides the obvious surface flaws? Like, so good. These are like smart bombs. You point them in the right direction and shit gets real.
Jennifer.
Mm-hmm. Talking about her boobs.
Yep.
What's up, Vagisil?
That's Jennifer, right?
It was Needy.
Was it?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes. It's in the big, yep. Okay. Now I remember when they kind of first said, yep. Okay.
Yeah, they had these like really mean nicknames for each other. Yeah. So, I mean, that's about it. Thank you for talking with me. And
thanks for having me.
Of course.
A lot of fun.
Yeah, no, it was a good conversation. So, yeah.
Satan is our only hope. We're in league with the beast now, and we have to make a really big impression on him. And to do that, we're going to have to butcher you.
Now it's time for the true horrors of it all. This possession flick bears a striking resemblance to a very real murder, the case of Elise Pollard. It was July 22nd, 1995. The predators lured 15-year-old Elise Poehler from her home in Rio Grande, California. Under the guise of hanging out and smoking marijuana, Elise met up with 16-year-old Royce Casey, 15-year-old Jacob DeLashmet, and 14-year-old Joseph Fiorella in a eucalyptus grove on the Nipomo Mesa, a distance of less than a quarter mile from her own home. Almost immediately, the boys ambushed Elise. They brutally killed her and, on more than one occasion, desecrated her body. The culprits stabbed her at least a dozen times. However, an autopsy would later determine that these wounds were non-fatal on their own. The eventual cause of death was massive blood loss. Elise's family reported her missing the same day, but were met with some resistance by local law enforcement. Unconfirmed sightings of Elise reported to local papers such as the Santa Maria Times in the days that followed certainly didn't help matters. Police ultimately chalked Elise's disappearance up to a simple case of runaway teen. Authorities quickly put the case on the back burner until about 8 months later in March of 1996, when Royce Casey walked into a local police station to confess to the crime and bring authorities to Elise's body. Royce Casey gave a full confession, implicating his two co-conspirators, and provided a motive. Elise Poehler was a sacrifice to Satan. The plot to kill Elise Poehler was a carefully concocted one. At the time of the murder, Elise, the eldest daughter of David and Lasani Poehler, was going through a bit of a rebellious phase. In high school, she started defying her parents and allegedly developed a problem with drugs and alcohol. Following an incident with Elise using marijuana at school, her parents sent her to a drug rehabilitation center. There, she met Jacob DeLashmet. Through Jacob, she met Royce and Joseph. The authorities already viewed the three young men as troublemakers. Similar to the plot of Jennifer's Body, these teens committed murder so Satan would make them famous. They explained that thrash metal band Slayer was one of their main inspirations, so much so that they started their own band called Hatred. By the summer of 1995, it was evident the band wasn't gaining the popularity they had hoped for. So Joseph came up with an eerily similar solution to the one employed by the band in Jennifer's Body, a deal with the devil. By all accounts, it seems they set their sights on Elise right away. They believed the blonde-haired, blue-eyed virgin would make the perfect sacrifice. However, they didn't actually carry out a satanic ritual they had planned, which would have involved dismemberment and cannibalism. Instead, they opted to spend more time hiding Elise's body. Royce, Jacob, and Joseph were all tried separately in 1997. They all received life sentences with the possibility of parole after 26 years for Joseph and Jacob, and after 21 years for Royce. To my knowledge, they're all still in jail and serving their life sentences. Let's end on a high note. Alright, so I've got my weekly horror update here. Since the movie I covered is Jennifer's Body, I wanted to talk about the possibility of there being a sequel. This is something that has been kind of flirted around in the horror news outlets. And so Amanda Seyfried, she says, "I think we're making another one," Seyfried tells a fan on a TikTok clip. "I didn't confirm it," I said. "I think," she winks. So there's a lot of like flirting around the idea of there being a second installment of this movie. And then writer Diablo Cody said that they're working on it. This news came out last month, and I'm excited to see what comes of it. Cody also declared that Lisa Frankenstein is set in the same universe as Jennifer's body. So it will be interesting to see if they have some like overlap between those two films. That'd be pretty cool. There is a teaser trailer for Hell House LLC Lineage. It's not only the first film in the franchise to get a wide theatrical release, but it also is ditching the found footage format. I'm curious to see how that's going to affect the performance of this film, since so many people love the fact that it is found footage. It's, I don't know how I feel about that yet. So this week we got three first look images from I Know What You Did Last Summer, introducing the new cast while reintroducing legacy characters, Julie and Ray. The 90s horror saga returns to the big screen on July 18th. The Norwegian body horror movie, The Ugly Stepsister, will be released in theaters on April 18th. The darkly entertaining fairy tale horror film is written and directed by Emily Blichfeldt. I think that's correct. As we get closer to the release date, I am very much anticipating this film, and I've seen some new trailers come out recently that definitely show the body horror side of this. And fairy tales are not meant to be these whimsical, loving stories. Like, they're really dark stories that teach a lesson about humanity and very dark sides of humanity. So I'm always excited to see a fairy tale horror movie. My horror trivia event will be based on the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise. That is going to be next Tuesday on the 15th. I'm very excited. I made some new reels for that. We're starting to really promote that event and push it. My last event was basically sold out. Like, there were no more seats at Conduit to be grabbed. I'm hoping for a turnout like that again, because that was pretty amazing. I'll try to get some more footage. Like, I think I really need to like have someone and be like, hey, you're taking video. You're going to help me out with this, because I'm up there. I'm the host. It's not just like your typical trivia. I have mystery prizes, photo opportunities that I set up. I'm actually working on making a prop phone from the first Nightmare on Elm Street. It's going to be the phone when Nancy's on the phone and then his like tongue sticks out. So I'm creating that. It's probably my favorite of the franchises. I just love Freddy Krueger. We got a new projector at Conduit, so it's looking really good too when I play the movie. So at my events, there's also themed drinks, costume contest at the end. And the prize that I got for the costume contest this time is a Freddy Krueger Funko Pop. And then you're going to also get two tickets to an Endoxa booking concert that is taking place at Conduit. So you'll get two comped tickets if you are the winner. If you've ever been to these events, I also have a bit of humor and some hot takes on things within the franchise. I will be discussing the true horrors that influenced Wes Craven's creation of Freddy Krueger, and there are deaths and nightmares linked to the creation of this franchise. So that will be an interesting piece that I will be discussing at the event. This is a weekly podcast with a new episode out every Thursday. All the research, writing, and audio is done by yours truly. This is a one-woman show, and I'm doing my very best. Please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen. Sharing is caring. Please share any of the content I make that resonates with you. I'm halfway, more than halfway to my goal of 10,000 followers to suffice the social media gods. It really means a lot, and thank you to everyone that has been doing these things. If you have any questions, want to collaborate, or maybe you want to correct me on something, you can email me at screamqueenpodcaster@gmail.com. You can also find me on Instagram at screamqueenpodcaster, Blue Sky at screamqueenpodcast, TikTok at screamqueenpodcast, and there is a link tree that will take you to YouTube and Facebook as well. Don't be a goober. Until next time, goodbye. Hee hee.